Carl Hart, thanks for joining us from Columbia University. Juan Gonzalez will be speaking in Seattle tonight.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Good evening. This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Time for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's Halloween will be the first dry one in 10 years.
The 45th President's fancy border wall prototypes were released this week.
A white supremacist message in the Multnomah County voter pamphlet.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 27th, 2017. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. If you have been leafing through your November 7th Multnomah County Special Elections voter pamphlet, you may have noticed a disturbing addition. On page 20, an overt white supremacist argument is printed opposing the PCC bond measure that would help update PCC's facilities, including modernizing the Portland Metropolitan Workforce Training Center, biology labs, classrooms, and nursing education suites at the Sylvania campus. The argument against the community college bond states the measure should be denied as punishment for PCC declaring its campus as a sanctuary campus, saying, quote, PCC's illegal alien sanctuary policy insults law-abiding taxpayers. Hold PCC accountable. Vote no on the PCC bond. End quote. The argument against the bond also states PCC should also be held accountable for the college's annual Whiteness History Month project, calling it, quote, nonsense. End quote. According to PCC, the project is in its second year of production. The Whiteness History Month project is, instead of being a celebratory event, a project where interdisciplinary platforms, including lectures, are used to master the narrative of race and racism while exploring the social construct of whiteness. The controversial argument in opposition of the bond was written by Richard R. LaMountain, a loud anti-immigration writer and organizer and the current vice president of the anti-immigration group called Oregonians for Immigration Reform. The group successfully blocked access to driver ID cards for people who couldn't verify legal residence in the U.S. with the veto referendum known as Measure 88.
Despite Congress not having yet provided funding for the project, the 45th President of the United States has been reviewing prototypes for his hyped-up wall to be built along the U.S.'s southern border. Photos of the prototype show plain concrete facades for the Mexico-facing sides and beautiful modern patterns involving steel slats and cylinders on the U.S.-facing sides. to reinforce commitments to the border wall. The Trump administration unveiled the 8 examples this week, the prototype's project, the wall being about 30 feet high. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection will spend the next 2 months hitting walls with large hammers and attempting to scale them. The agency's acting deputy commissioner, Ronald Vitello, said at a recent press event in the California desert where the prototypes sit near the border, quote, "Can it be climbed? Can it be dug under? Can it withstand cutting tools? The wall is vitally important for the future of border security." The prototypes have been built by 6 different private companies and cost between $300,000 and $500,000 each. The administration is seeking $1.6 billion from Congress for the first phase of the project. Trump famously promised that Mexico would pay for the wall, but Mexico has publicly declared it will not be doing that. Possible legal challenges aimed at preventing the wall, both from property owners near the border and the state of California, are also looming around the project, potentially holding up its progress.
Catalonia has declared freedom from Spain. Tensions reached a boiling point today when Catalan lawmakers ended weeks of political struggle by declaring the region's independence by a symbolic vote. Reuters has reported that outside the regional parliament, over 2,000 people shouted the word liberty and sang traditional songs as the vote proceeded. Thousands and thousands of independent supporters gathered in the town squares and streets of Catalonia to celebrate. But even as the joyous scenes took over the area, the backlash to the decision began. Spain's parliament voted to strip Catalonia of its autonomy and impose direct rule. Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said that the Spanish cabinet has decided to dismiss the Catalan government, fire the Catalan police chief, and hold new elections in Catalonia on December 21st. Governments across Europe, as well as the U.S. State Department, came out in support of the Spanish government. In the meantime, Spain's constitutional court said it has begun the steps for reviewing the independence declaration.
A top journalist at Russia's most prominent independent radio station was stabbed in the neck Monday after a string of recent attacks and threats against Russian media. Tatiana Felgahauer, the deputy editor and host of Echo Moscow, was hospitalized in a medically induced coma after an assailant broke into the station offices and attacked her. The Associated Press reported, Felgahauer is in stable but serious condition. The attacker has been identified as 48-year-old Boris Gritz and has been apprehended. He told investigators he had a, quote, telepathic contact with Felgahauer and had a personal grudge against her. The Guardian has reported earlier that Echo Moscow staff have been attacked before. The radio station has been decried by state-owned media and its journalists have been threatened with death. Yulia Latnina left Russia this year after an attempted arson attack on her car.
The League of Women Voters of Portland are holding an open dialogue on free speech and civil discourse with Matt DeSantos of the Portland ACLU and Michael Mills of Portland State University's National Policy Consensus Center. The program will be held Tuesday, November 14th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. in the Multnomah County Boardroom at 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. The panel will help tackle difficult questions around free speech dynamics, but doesn't make any promises to give perfect formulaic answers, but food for thought for the holidays ahead. The Civic Education Program is free and open to the public. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and with parking nearby and several TriMet and Portland streetcar options nearby. The forum will be recorded by Metro East Community Media for rebroadcast and online streaming at www.lwvpdx.org.
Leave your raincoats, umbrellas, and extra layers at home this year because Oregon will be enjoying its first rain-free Halloween in 10 years. Halloween typically is a damp night of celebrating in the Northwest, with thick evening fog often rolling in and the first of the region's rainforest-like downpours choosing this particular night to arrive. 2007 was the last dry Halloween that Oregon has seen, and the night will be mostly clear, dotted with clouds here and there, and temperatures slightly cooler than other nights this week. Happy haunting!
Just when you thought you could settle in for a warm fall, meteorologist David Bishop from the National Weather Service in Portland says that next week, the Portland area could see snowfall by Sunday due to snow levels dipping down to 2,500 feet Friday and going into Saturday morning, Bishop said. Bishop said this far out, we're low confidence. Any models by then will have a tendency to change. He also added, whether it will be drastically or whether it will hold us is basically a flip of the coin. Winter will be approaching quicker than most people think.
And now we hear from our colleagues from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. It's Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Each year, trick-or-treaters fill their bags with chocolate, but climate change could put this Halloween treat in jeopardy.
As temperatures rise and rainfall patterns change, some of the current cocoa-producing regions may become less suitable for producing cocoa.
That's Kevin Rabinovich for Mars Incorporated. He says cocoa only grows well in the tropics, near the equator. More than two-thirds of the world's supply is grown in West Africa, where drought is already a problem. To help address climate change, Mars plans to slash carbon pollution from its products by 67% by mid-century. That includes reducing emissions from land use changes and agriculture. The company is also helping cocoa farmers increase yields.
Increasing yields reduces the demand for land, which is one of the big pressures behind deforestation. And deforestation is, of course, a significant driver of climate change.
Higher yields also make farmers and chocolate makers more resilient to climate impacts. And one day, so might new cocoa varieties. Mars and others are encouraging research to develop drought-resistant plants. After all,
there's no chocolate without cocoa, and none of us want to contemplate a world without chocolate.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now it's your daily dose of labor history. It's Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1948. That was the day that a thick yellow fog rolled over the town of Denora, Pennsylvania, just south of Pittsburgh. Denora was a mill town nestled in a valley on the banks of the Monongahela River. By 1948, the town had grown to 14,000 people who came to work in the town's steel mills and the Denora Zinc Works. For years, the local residents had complained about the pollution that spilled from the plants. Smog was a regular occurrence, but this fog was even worse than usual. A layer of cold air was trapping a noxious blend of nitrogen dioxide, sulfuric acid, and fluoride pollution. 24 hours passed, and still the fog grew denser. The police and local doctors began to receive reports of people having difficulty breathing. The fog had become so thick that residents could not see to drive. For 5 days, the smog hung over the town until a rain began to break it up. Nearly half of the town's residents became ill. 20 died. U.S. Steel refused to take blame for the fog, even though they continued to run the plant as the deadly toxins continued to build. According to a 2010 article by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, despite the efforts of industry to cast the tragedy as an act of God, the fatalities in Denora received national attention. The event changed the way air pollution was viewed, moving it rapidly from an aesthetic issue to a public health concern, and spurred local, state, and federal officials to control toxic air pollution. In 2008, a smog museum opened with the motto, Clean Air Starts Here. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a counterspin. Then at 6, it's Native America Calling. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will have a low of 56 with clear skies and gentle breezes. Same for the Dalles and Hood River and all the way to the coast. Tomorrow's weather is clear and warm with a high of 69 from Portland to the Gorge. Slightly cooler and cloudier in Lincoln City. Today in history, in 1960, the civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was released from the Georgia State Prison following a direct intervention from Robert F. Kennedy, who had questioned his constitutional right to bail while pending appeal for a traffic violation. The quote of the day is from the band A Perfect Circle from their song Blue off the album The 13th Step. It says, quote, Just ignore the smoke and smile.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Human sex trafficking has increased significantly throughout the U.S. and on tribal lands in recent years. Lawmakers on the Navajo Nation are taking steps to prevent it. KNAU's Ryan Heinches reports.
Navajo officials passed the tribe's first law to fight human trafficking in July. It increases penalties and broadens tribal jurisdiction to allow prosecutions in such cases. Navajo Council Delegate Nathaniel Brown is a member of the Arizona Human Trafficking Council and spearheaded the tribe's law. He says the main challenge is education.
There's no word in Navajo for human trafficking. We have to come together and call it what it is. Even though the law is passed, there's still this lack of knowledge on what human trafficking is.
Officials plan to begin training tribal police, educators, and the general public to recognize human trafficking when it happens. The tribe doesn't currently have data for trafficking on the Navajo Nation, and Brown says one of his main priorities is to commission a study to show its extent. A report from the Office of Sex Trafficking Intervention Research at Arizona State University shows trafficking involving minors in the U.S. has more than tripled in recent years. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The mother of a Native American player in Maine says she will appeal the findings of a school board after it concluded no intentional acts of racism toward Native Americans took place during a recent football game. Maine Public Radio's A.J. Higgins has more.
Amelia Tuplin of Lisbon, Maine, says her family was subjected to taunts and whoops by players and fans as they were leaving the field of the Wells Warriors.
At this point, I will sit on it for a few days, and if I do not get a response. I've had legal representation contact me, and I've also looked into filing a complaint with the State of Maine Human Rights Commission.
Wells Ogunquit, CSD Superintendent James Daly, says he is willing to meet with Tuplin to discuss the matter further. Meanwhile, board members have signaled an interest in reviewing its team name and American Indian mascot. For National Native News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
The Bangor Daily News reports a school board meeting is scheduled for next week. Community members and educators are among those weighing in on the issue and the school's Indian mascot. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court Thursday challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act. The lawsuit is on behalf of a foster family. A non-native Texas family wants to adopt a 2-year-old Native American child who they've fostered since he was 10 months old. According to a press release from the Attorney General, the biological parents and grandmother support the adoption. The law was created in the 1970s and is intended to keep Native children with Native families. The Akchen Indian community in Arizona will recognize marriage for same-sex couples. The Arizona Republic reports its tribal court has ruled same-sex couples have a fundamental right to marry under both tribal and federal law. The decision comes after a 2-year legal battle by a Native woman and her partner. The tribe will reportedly not appeal the ruling. 4 other Arizona tribes are said to also recognize same-sex marriage. U.S. senators on the Indian Affairs Committee urge for improved public safety in Indian country and more resources for victim services. The committee reviewed 3 bills this week intended to promote public safety in tribal communities. 2 bills seek funding and reauthorization of the Tribal Law and Order Act of 2010. The 3rd bill addresses murdered and missing Indigenous women. It would also promote more accurate data collection on missing persons in Indian country and enhance coordination between federal, state, and tribal agencies. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Now it's time for the Green Report's weekly wrap-up covering Hurricane Sandy's 5th anniversary, Puerto Rico's cleanup contract, and Flat Earther's attempt at scientific validity are up next.
There's a lot that's head-scratching about this contract.
Tiny Montana company's mysterious $300 million contract to repair Puerto Rico's electric grid.
A bleak picture of the economic costs of climate change.
GAO reports climate disasters have already cost U.S. taxpayers $350 billion.
I appreciate and I respect both sides of the science.
Trump's U.S. ambassador to Canada invents new form of climate denial. Plus,
we're going to get more and more of these extreme events.
On the fifth anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, new study warns no U.S. city is prepared for climate change impacts.
Hey, happy anniversary. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I cut more regulations in 9 months than any president has cut during the entire term that they're in.
Dump anything you want into the drinking water, because you know what they say, when life hands you paint thinner, make people drink paint thinner aid.
Don't give me any ideas. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, still trying to make sense of this really strange, really bizarre story from Puerto Rico and Whitefish, Montana.
Yes, congressional lawmakers are calling for a review of a huge $300 million contract that was awarded to a tiny two-year-old Montana company, Whitefish Energy Holdings, to repair Puerto Rico's electric grid without a competitive bidding process and despite its lack of experience handling such massive projects.
They had only two people there when they got this project, right?
That's right.
So, Desi, you and I could have done that contract for $150
million. Easily. FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers say they were surprised by the unusual arrangement. Whitefish has links to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, being located in his hometown, but the Interior Department denied any involvement. The Puerto Rico Power Authority, PREPA, said Whitefish had already bid on reconstruction after Hurricane Irma and were the fastest to respond. Now, Whitefish isn't the only small company getting an unusually massive contract for Puerto Rico. Cobra Acquisitions of Oklahoma, the home state of Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt, also signed a $200 million contract to repair the island's electric grid.
Home state of Zinke, home state of Pruitt, $500 million between them. Total coincidence, I assume.
Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rossello has defended the contract, but on Wednesday he said his administration will review PREPA's contracting practices.
Good.
On Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Financial Oversight Board that's overseeing Puerto Rico's financial crisis is installing an emergency manager over the island's electric utility with the explicit goal of fully privatizing the public power company. Former Puerto Rico Power Commissioner Ramon Cruz tells the Green News Report, quote, "This decision is unfortunate. What Puerto Rico needs is more transparency in the decision-making process about its future, not an unelected board." Meanwhile, October 29th marks the fifth anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, at 1,000 miles wide, the largest hurricane ever recorded in the Atlantic Ocean, that caused the worst flooding in New York and New Jersey state history, and one of the most expensive weather disasters ever to hit the United States. A new study published this week concludes that Sandy-like catastrophic floods are likely to become much more frequent due to rising sea levels, and will do that soon, projecting that, for example, costly floods that now strike the New York City area once every 25 years could hit once every 5 years by 2040. And they warn no U.S. coastal city is prepared. And now a report by the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office released this week warns that failure to confront climate change has already cost taxpayers more than $350 billion over the last decade.
How much?
$350 billion. In 10 years, paid in direct disaster aid, crop insurance, floods, wildfires, and repairs to federal infrastructure caused by weather disasters that scientists concluded were worsened by climate change.
Yeah, but ExxonMobil stock is up.
The GAO projects that the burden on taxpayers will grow rapidly by mid-century. The GAO says there are uncertainties in its predictions, but it's known for being quite conservative in its estimates. So it turns out it's actually more expensive to not act on climate change.
as you have told us.
And finally, despite the GAO's warning, the Trump administration is doubling down on climate science denial. New U.S. ambassador to Canada and former Republican fundraiser Kelly Kraft, who happens to be married to a billionaire coal baron, tried out a new stance on climate denial in an interview with the CBC.
I believe there are sciences that are both on both sides that are accurate. Both sides have, you know, they have their own results from their studies, and I appreciate and I respect both sides of the science.
So this woman thinks there's good evidence that the Earth is both flat and round.
Both sides.
Well done. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The freedoms of working people are under attack, and these attacks are causing real pain for working families. It's an all-out assault by corporations, CEOs, and their politicians. It's a well-funded, coordinated attack.
America's labor movement, its largest labor federation, is meeting in St. Louis at its quadrennial convention. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka set the tone as he accepted election for another term.
We build the cars and planes and infrastructure from the East Coast to the West Coast, north to south. We, the American worker, makes America strong. We don't duck. We don't run. We are the American labor movement, and we will not be denied.
Call it labor's Spirit of St. Louis. The solidarity of the AFL-CIO labor delegates gathered for their convention in St. Louis is up against one of the most challenging times in the history of the labor movement. Dan Duncan is Executive Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO's Maritime Trades Department.
There's a heck of a fighting spirit on the convention floor, and people are saying, okay, if we're going to fight, let's fight. Let's give it everything we've got.
American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox says a fighting solidarity spirit is alive and growing in his union.
AFGE is a fighting union. Our members are fighters. We are seeing our membership continuously grow. We're seeing the activism of our members get more concerned, more focused. People are engaging like they have never engaged before.
Speaking at the AFL-CIO convention, United Mine Workers of America President Cecil Roberts cited the power and solidarity the labor movement still has to deliver results for its members and retirees. The miners' union waged a multi-year battle to save the pensions of coal mine retirees threatened by corporate maneuvers and bankruptcies. They succeeded in winning money both from the coal companies and from Congress.
And we went to jail in the rain, and we went to jail in the snow, and we went to jail in the sunshine.
Port truck drivers from Los Angeles, Long Beach, and New Jersey took their fight for justice on the job to Capitol Hill Thursday. The truckers are misclassified as contractors instead of employees, and they face wage theft and other exploitation. U.S. Representatives Napolitano and Nadler are introducing two bills, the Port Drivers' Bill of Rights Act of 2017 and the Clean Ports Act of 2017, to end a system of forcing port truck drivers into illegal leases as contractors. The port truckers, like Daniel Seiko Uena, say that port truckers have their wages stolen, often have to wait long hours without being paid at the ports, and must take on all of the company's overhead burdens.
Pay for the equipment, meaning the truck, the fuel, the lease, and it's on the backs of us drivers, and we need to change it.
Workers Independent News, provided by Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Tonight's newscast is brought to you with special thanks to Native Voice One, the Yale Center for Environmental Communications, and our friends at the Pacifica Network. The producer for tonight's newscast is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Liam Delta. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Coming up on Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on More Talk Radio, Cecil and Celeste look at mass incarceration and the war on drugs with Nicole Lindahl from the Portland Underground Graduate School. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the great issues of our time and goes where corporate media fears to tread. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes Eric Deplace from the Sightline Institute to discuss fires, floods, and Trump, plus lessons that will enable a livable future. At 11, it's What Are You Listening To?, a show that asks guests about the music that is important to them and why. What's on your current playlist and how does it impact your daily life? KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member today. Thank you for listening and have a good evening. Good night, Jenna.
Night, Ruben. Night, Liam.
Nighty night.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, thanks mainly to independent and social media, and of course activism like Black Lives Matter, Americans have been forced to confront and to know more about police brutality and racism in the criminal justice system than just a few years ago. But corporate media conversation about what to do with that knowledge is constrained. We may hear editorial calls for better training or more data, or sometimes even convictions of individual officers. But somehow we never see the